Welcome to Couples Therapy in 7 Words. I am your co-host, Judy Alexander, and I'm here with my husband, Dr. Bruce Chalmer.
Hello, Judy, and welcome to our listeners. This is episode number 6, and we're very excited to be doing these. Today, we have a special guest. It's Rabbi David Edelson, and we'll be introducing him a little bit later. But the topic for today, Judy, tell us what the topic is.
It is trauma and relationships.
And as we have been going along in the book, and what book is that? It's the book Reigniting the Spark, Why Stable Couples Lose Intimacy and How to Get It Back. This is the next chapter as we've been going along the chapters. And we're talking about trauma and relationships because in my 7-word formula, which is what this podcast is named after, be kind, don't panic, and have faith, we're in the panic section. And trauma is one of the big reasons why people find themselves going into panic. So what do I mean by trauma in this case? The term trauma, as used by psychologists, refers to something bad that happened to you. Now, of course, lots of bad things can happen to us in the course of a lifetime. But if it's still having a traumatic effect, what that means is that even after the trauma is over, even after the bad thing that was happening is no longer happening, you can still be triggered. And what that means is if you're reminded of whatever bad thing happened to you, your body can go into emergency mode, into fight or flight or freeze mode. And I write about that in the book because that can certainly have a lot of effects on relationships. The way evolution works, we are the descendants of people who learned that if something seems dangerous because we've experienced it as dangerous before, we'd better experience anxiety about it. We better do something. Anxiety is a message from our body that says, do something different, you might be in danger.
So what's the difference between anxiety and trauma?
Well, anxiety, as I'm using the term, is that feeling that says, uh-oh, something is really wrong. Trauma, again, as I'm using the term, you know, in medical terms, trauma just refers to something, you know, injures you. Mm-hmm. You know, that's trauma to your body. But as I'm using the term, trauma refers to a residual effect later on that says something bad happened that caused your body to be in emergency mode. And if you're even reminded of it, and it may not even be a conscious reminder, if you're reminded of the trauma, then your body goes into emergency mode when in fact you're not actually in danger.
Mm-hmm. So it's like you're re-experiencing it again?
That would be sort of an extreme form of it. Yeah, if you actually, that's what a flashback is. In a flashback, somebody actually feels in that moment that they're actually re-experiencing whatever the bad thing was. I say bad thing, I don't mean to understate that. It can be really horrible events in someone's life, sexual abuse or rape or combat situations or any sort of situation where you feel like you're imminently in mortal danger. That's the kind of thing that anxiety, that panic really is designed for.
So how does that play out in relationships?
Well, that's where it gets, shall we say, interesting and difficult both. Because in a relationship, you are frequently being reminded of pretty much any other relationship you've ever had. So if you're in a relationship, let's say a couple relationship, and say you've been hurt badly in a previous relationship, then whatever your partner does that reminds you of being hurt by the previous partner could be the sort of thing that triggers you, that puts your body in emergency mode. And when your body goes in emergency mode, you really can't think. And it's not just you really can't think, but pretty much everything is driven by this underlying need to survive. And that is not very conducive to hearing, let's say, if your partner is just happens to be annoyed with you or your partner happens to need some help with something. If you're triggered, you're just not available for that. And that can be very difficult. And of course, what often happens in couples is that if one person is triggered, it can have the effect of triggering the other. So one person's response of shutting down could have the effect of triggering another person's response if they are freaking out because they've been abandoned in the past. And this is a fairly frequent pattern you see in couples.
So does that mean one partner has to put up a trigger warning?
Well, you mentioned trigger warnings. Yeah, that's a hot topic, actually.
Oh, is that right?
I was going to deal with trigger warnings in the book, and I realized whatever I said was bound to become you know, it would be misinterpreted by somebody, and then it would become this big deal about, oh, he's saying trigger warnings are good. No, he's saying trigger warnings are bad. And of course, my view on trigger warnings is they have elements of good and elements of bad in them. But no, it doesn't mean that, you know, partners have to go around giving trigger warnings. But it, for people who may not be familiar with the concept, trigger warnings are designed to help people who have a history of trauma be able to decide if they want to be involved in whatever the activity is. A classic example of it is in academic settings where a professor might say, look, we're about to read some literature and this literature has a rape scene or a combat scene or whatever it may be. And it gives people a chance to decide, wow, is that going to be too upsetting for me to actually be able to participate in the class? So the good parts of trigger warnings are that it's considerate of people's actual experience. And, you know, the controversy around trigger warnings arose in circumstances where there have been, and actually, unfortunately, continue to be, a lot of people who deny the real effects of trauma on people, and they can be very cruel about it.
Mm.
And so the good side of trigger warnings is it's trying to be considerate of people who suffer greatly when they are exposed unexpectedly to some things that can cause them to experience great anxiety.
Sure.
So I absolutely respect that. The downside of trigger warnings is that, unfortunately, if you live, if you've been traumatized and live your life in a way so as to avoid any exposure to something that might remind you of it, mm-hmm. you simply won't heal.
Mm.
So trigger warnings inadvertently can have the effect of preventing someone from healing.
Mm-hmm.
Which is also unfortunate.
Yeah.
So I don't want us to get lost in all the controversy around that, but it is an interesting topic, and maybe someday we'll do a show on that one.
Okay.
But for today, I think what we'd like to get to is our interview with Rabbi Edelson, because we do touch on some issues involving trauma with him, and really also a whole lot of other really interesting stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So Judy, why don't you go ahead and introduce our recorded interview with Rabbi Edelson.
Sure. As Bruce mentioned, our guest today is Rabbi David Edelson, who is the rabbi at Temple Sinai Reform Congregation in South Burlington, Vermont. And by way of full disclosure, that's the synagogue where I am the education director and where Bruce and I are members. Rabbi Edelson grew up in rural Georgia, and while in high school he began studying Judaism, falling in love with the smart, judicious reasoning of the rabbis, as well as the audacity of the Jewish reformists and organizers. After college, he and his partner Tim spent 2 years in Jerusalem, where David taught Jewish student leaders from around the world at the Kiryat Moria Education Center near Jerusalem. While in Jerusalem, he began his rabbinic studies at the Hebrew Union College, from which he received his ordination in New York in 1990. During his years in rabbinical school, he was a founding member of Tamar, the Reform Zionist Youth Movement, and of Hinenu, the gay rabbinical student organization that was pivotal in the successful fight for ordination of LGBT clergy in the Reform movement. Rabbi Edelson served 25 years as the rabbi for the Hebrew Association of the Deaf in New York, learning and then creating services and sermons in American Sign Language. He also teaches religion, ethics, and literature on the college level and served as the first Dean of Cook Commons at Middlebury College. Rabbi Edelson received his honorary Doctor of Divinity from Hebrew Union College in 2015 and served as the spiritual leader of the Bethlehem Hebrew Congregation in New Hampshire before coming to Temple Sinai. We are thrilled to have Rabbi Edelson with us today. Here's our interview, recorded on July 2nd, 2020. Hi, David.
Hi, Judy. Hi, Bruce. How are you guys doing?
We're great. How are you?
Good. Doing well. Thank you.
Good. Well, let's get started today. As a rabbi, can you tell us about your work with couples? When you're working with couples and you're also the rabbi of the community, how does that affect your work when you're not just in a counseling relationship?
Well, I think rabbinic counseling can be different than therapy in significant ways. It's very important that I look at the spiritual questions they're looking at, like not just what is the technique of getting through this argument. That's not my role. my role is to try to look at what is some of the deeper issues. Are you even in love anymore? Is this a thing that you want to improve on? Or are you coming to me to let me know that you're done with this and you're trying to figure out how to unwind this relationship? Mm. And I think that's not that different than most treatment professionals.
Well, just from the standpoint that you, you know, not only see them as a rabbi, but you're also involved with them in a community sense. So you have that personal relationship with people, whereas, you know, when they come to a therapist such as Bruce, you know, he sees them only in that capacity.
Yeah, I'm in a situation where if I know somebody externally in any way deeper than just to sort of know who they are, I can't see them as a therapist. Whereas you're working with members of your community, you know, you're in a particular position, but you know them, you see them at, you know, at a Kiddush or an Onik Shabbat.
Well, I think one of the advantages and disadvantages is that where in therapy, you can't bring in other things you know, and you're not supposed to know them, but I'm not constrained by that rule. In other words, I don't just have to listen to what they say to me. I can reflect, well, I've seen a couple of situations where I noticed this with you in this community setting, or, you know, I can push back. Well, I hear that, but that doesn't feel to me like the whole thing there. Mm. So of course, like any therapist that you run into clients out in the community, you really have to have good boundaries and know just when to not react and what not to say. And we all do our best at that, and sometimes imperfectly. Mm-hmm. But I do think I'm doing much more of a kind of triage, a kind of pointing out like what I've noticed, what I see in them, if I do know them. Of course, there are people in my community I don't know as well as others, but to try to bring what I've seen to maybe help reflect that to them. Because I think a lot of times couples don't know actually how they're perceived in the community. They're not really aware of that, like lots of people all could say the same thing about what's wrong with their relationship, but no one says it's to them. So not that I do that necessarily, but there are times when I can gently maybe bring that up in a way that in a therapy session would be inappropriate.
Yeah, yeah, it's interesting that they're coming to you. Of course, you're a rabbi. You haven't hung out a shingle that says, you know, marriage therapy or something. You're a rabbi, probably their rabbi. And so they're looking for a particular perspective that is, first of all, pastoral rather than clinical, but also Jewishly pastoral, right? And I'm sort of curious, how does that affect how you work with people?
Well, I would almost turn that around. I'm not sure that people are always sure what they're looking for. A lot of times, they do come to me on the way to going to therapy, but a lot of times people have been in therapy and come to me for the other component. So one of the things that I have to clarify is, why did you decide to come to me specifically, especially if they're already in treatment for a long time? And then it is much more of a spiritual conversation, and I focus much more on techniques for them to remain grounded, for them to remain in touch with their spirit, with their spirituality, so that even amongst all the turmoil, maybe I can give them some techniques to stay grounded out of the belief that you're going to make better decisions and do better in the relationship, regardless of what happens, if you're grounded, if you're not becoming terribly upset or just thrown off your sense of self. Like when you're thrown off your sense of self, you don't make good decisions and you can't listen. So I think I spend time talking about different meditation techniques and prayer techniques that might help.
That was going to be my next question. If you could share with us some of what those techniques are. So it involves prayer, meditation.
Sure. One of the things that I think works well is to have some daily practice. Now, that daily practice can be tailored to different people and what works for them, especially if they're in turmoil. Me imposing something that doesn't work for them, I don't think is helpful. So I try to ask them like what they normally do to get grounded, what are times in their lives where they needed that skill and what worked for them there. And then I try to think of Jewish ideas that fit with what already works for them. So for example, if somebody really already meditates or breathing is in their practice, then we can talk about wrapping a prayer shawl, a tallit around them, and a specific kind of meditation about the inner light meeting with the outer light and finding a bit of balance there before conversation. If a tallis is something they've never thought of, or it just feels like a barrier, not an invitation, then we can talk about chanting or singing, and some people reading. I mean, honestly, some people are all different that way. And for some people, it's cooking. So I know I've worked with clients that, you know, when they got off their game, they go try to, you know, make a challah because it got them back grounded. And I guess what I'm working out of is if you have a daily practice that you know you can go to and at least to some degree get back to your center, then you don't panic as much. And then you can hold the discomfort a bit better, knowing that there'll be a time that day where you can address it. So I try to talk about morning and evening or you know, before bed so that you have dependable times. And if it's something around grief, not a relationship, which is not what this is about, like maybe it's a time to look at pictures. And a lot of relationship endings are very much about loss. And so working with people about the grief that comes with that and how to process that in ways that might be more effective come up a lot. And it could be something as simple as like take 15 minutes a day and look through the pictures of when you were first together and feel the loss, you know? And people's like, well, that's just gonna make me feel worse. And I'm like, well, it might, but it might actually remind you why you were in this and make you feel like, oh, this was good. And now
that's a segue that offers a segue actually into, you know, the theme we're talking about on today's show has to do with trauma. And just, you know, for full disclosure for the audience, David hasn't heard our intro to this that you've already heard, but the theme is about issues around trauma. And, you know, in terms of my book, which I happen to know you've read because you offered some incredibly helpful comments. That's another full disclosure for the audience here. Yeah.
And I enjoyed it very
so
much.
My overall formula was, you know, be kind, don't panic, and have faith. And I'm particularly interested, what you were just describing sounded to me like you were inviting that connection to people's faith. And of course, the techniques you're describing, and, you know, I thought of it when you said morning and evening and bedtime, and I'm thinking, oh, gee, you sound Jewish. You know? What a surprise, Rabbi, you know,
yeah.
That you're talking about things that are, or, you know, wrapping yourself in a tallit. You're talking about things that are very much traditional in Jewish practice, and that can, I wonder if sometimes the reason people would especially go to a rabbi, you know, not merely that, yes, you're a wonderful person, you are a wonderful person, but that's not the point. You're also a rabbi, which connects them with that sense of being part of something bigger, which is what faith is often all about. And that's how they can do exactly what you're saying about not panicking so much. You know, you can tolerate the anxiety, true of grief as well. You can, that's the other thing I mentioned, the segue. What you're talking about in terms of looking at pictures of people you've lost or looking at pictures of a marriage that you've lost is very much what people have to do to heal from trauma. You visit in a context where you still feel fundamentally emotionally grounded. And that's how you heal from trauma. I'm curious, is that, well, actually I have a follow-up to that, but if you can comment on that, I'm curious.
Well, there's a few things there. One is that I deal with both Jewish people who may have moved away from a very active Jewish practice or grew up in a home where they didn't have that. And part of what they're wanting to feel solid is a reconnection to that. But I have to say, I also work with interfaith families where it's the Jew by choice who is looking for more Jewish practice because it helps them stay grounded. So it's not a one size fits all, right? So if somebody grew up and was bar bat mitzvah, then I can speak much more about those Jewish practices from the get go. If somebody's less familiar with them, I want to try to connect them with those techniques. But I do think the morning and evening is a very Jewish moment. But I also think it's useful for trauma. And I think some of this came out of my own experience living through the AIDS epidemic in New York as a gay man. And while I was mercifully and gratefully spared my closest friends passing, I lost a lot of people. And I found that a lot of people just weren't dealing with it. And for me to go back to the hospital, to go back to the family, I needed to take some time myself regularly. And morning and evening, while it has a Jewish context, was also just at the beginning of the day and at the end of the day, which is part of the reason it's in the Jewish context, right? I found that that was important, that I had those structures to look forward to at regular intervals. And like you said, it was a way of remembering the parts of the relationships that weren't traumatized. It wasn't a form of denial. It was a form of balance. Because I think in trauma, our memories become, they lose balance. And what we remember and what stays playing in our heads over and over is the traumatic image or the traumatic moment. And so taking time to remember the whole relationship, while painful, is not traumatic. And that's different than somebody looking at pictures day, every day. Or that experience of a lot of people in relationships where they're ending, going through the tape in their head of, you know, trying to go through what the events were in the subconscious hope that it'll turn out differently this time through the thinking, which of course isn't going to happen because it's already, that's too late for that. So that tendency to get stuck in going over something over and over, I also focus a lot on trying to stop that. So if somebody's really in that place, I'm not going to say, look at these pictures twice a day, because that's not their issue. And in those cases, we try to work on, and I try to work on for myself as well, how to get your mind from going back over that tape again and again and again. And that's not easy. That's a habit issue as much as it's any kind of key that opens the door.
Mm-hmm. Are there any favorite texts that you find helpful that you've used, you know, with several couples, either Jewish texts or poems that you find have brought comfort to some of the couples you're counseling?
You know, that's a great question, Judy. I have used some texts, but I don't tend to be text focused. And I'll tell you why. If the person brings a text that's dear to them, then yes, of course. But I find that bringing text often pushes people into their head and they turn into analytical mind. And they also want to be good students, which is not what's needed at that moment. Where I would say I tend to focus on specific texts or single lines from text that I think you can have as almost a mantra that you can bring back up to yourself when you feel yourself getting into a bad place. So something like, with you is the source of light and by your light do we see light, is a very short line that I find very calming. Or there are other lines like that, but not so much texts about relationships, not so much that sort of textual study. I have sometimes used the ketubah, the marriage contract, to look at, you know, and especially these days as many people write their own, it actually is a really lovely way back into what was going on when you wrote that. And is there in there a seed of some way to work towards healing this relationship?
There's another element of trauma that I happen to know you have recently taught a course in anti-Semitism, actually. That is, actually, a few years ago, there was a conference sponsored in Vermont about working with Jewish clients. You know, it was for mostly for therapists, although I know there was at least one rabbi there. And I'm curious as to your take on that, like this specifically kind of Jewish thing that happens to us around issues of collective trauma of the Jewish people. I think some of that gets triggered. I know it got enormously triggered for me around 9/11. It even gets triggered, and not to culturally appropriate something, but it gets triggered for me around issues that the Black community has gone through, especially because there's so much specific anti-Semitism happening around the same time. I'm curious about your take on any of that.
Well, I think that's a really good connection to your book, actually, because the don't panic part, right? What happens when we hear something anti-Semitic, it triggers us. It triggers me. And we all react to that differently. Some people become silent. Some people like me just want to respond and keep thinking of different responses, but it's still not very productive or helpful, right? So I think one of the things is the same techniques that when you feel yourself triggered by anti-Semitism or racism, to find ways to get yourself grounded and then think about it. One of the words that I would add in the book is timing. I found that, you know, some couples have that we won't go to bed angry, and that's never been something that worked for me. I guess my anger is a bit more enduring once it's kicked up. But I can't talk about this right now, but let's make a time to talk about this in a few days. Helps me a great deal. And I think in terms of things around anti-Semitism and other triggers, we can usually learn to feel when we're triggered. And if we have that, I'm triggered, then sometimes that's not the time to respond, even if everything in us is crying out to say something. Because again, honestly, with all that's been happening and with the pandemic and with the economy, lots of Jewish people, including Tim and I, talk about what should we do? should we stay? Where could we go? Like that's an old Jewish story. And we all grow up on those stories. So I don't know if it's epigenetic or just culturally transmitted, but between the two of those things, we all grow up with the sense of, is this the time to leave? And even those conversations aren't really helpful in the middle of a full-blown like terror or rage about racism or anti-Semitism. So even in that, I think things are complicated and you're gonna make better decisions if you can be grounded, be connected to God, be connected to your spiritual life, however you define that. You're gonna make better decisions. And then later, if it wasn't the best decision, because we don't always make the best decisions and we can't, we don't have all the information at a given time, you can be much more forgiving of the decision you made. If you were thoughtful and grounded while you were making, it's much easier to say, I did my best there. I find when I make rash decisions based on emotions only, it's much harder to make my peace with what I did than if I took some time to think about it.
Yeah, I also find in that same spirit that when I'm able to calm down from that triggered feeling, which, yes, I certainly recognize very well, that I'm actually able, and I think of this as an article of faith, really, I'm actually able to connect when I'm feeling more grounded, when I'm feeling more that sense of, wait a minute, reality is fundamentally right. I'm never going to say anti-Semitism or racism itself is right, but it arises out of valid human tendencies. And then I can actually entertain the fact that these people who are saying hateful things are still people. And I can connect with some sort of common humanity. Wouldn't, you know, I'm not a pacifist. It wouldn't mean that I would lay down my arms and let them kill me. But I would indeed, it works better when I have the sense that the people I'm dealing with are still people. And I know what rage feels like. And I can connect with that feeling sometimes. And that maybe that helps me cope with it.
I would actually say that's a core value, right? Like, which is another way of grounding. The core value is we're all humans. And if anti-Semitism is about dehumanizing Jewish people or racism is about dehumanizing people of color, African Americans, then when we start to go there, we need to stop it. So I think that's a value. And you asked about text earlier, Judy. I would say Yitz Greenberg's like three essential truths that basically we are all made in the image of God. We're all infinitely worthwhile and have worth as we are. And that every person is unique and that is good. You know, that those kinds of things I use in those moments, but also in relationships. And I think it's a starting point, right? It's a starting point of like, let's remember, you may hate each other right now, but you fundamentally believe that we're all good. We're human beings and we're doing our best and we don't do it well all the time. And if we can stay there, you may still decide this isn't working or it is working. But that's going to come from a much better place than if it's, I hate you, you're evil, which people do evil things. But in our tradition, people aren't evil. We're created good. And that's hard to remember sometimes, but it is a core value.
Right.
And I honestly do think sometimes those core values are really important in grounding ourselves.
Yeah.
And I think when you asked earlier, why do people come to a rabbi? I think what they're coming for often is less counseling and more reflection of those core values. I get a lot of calls like, is this ethical? And I try to work with people to look at that in a complex way. But I think sometimes they're asking me, is it ethical if I do this? As a modern reform rabbi, I see that as part of my role, but not my entire role.
Yeah, it's interesting that notion of going to the rabbi to find out if something is ethical. And that, you know, one of the things I like to point out is the thing about core values is that they better have derived from something other than just yourself. That, you know, the people, I think I mentioned this in the book, the people that we come to revere as having challenged established structures, challenged it from the viewpoint of venerable traditions, you know, like Dr. King or Gandhi or people like that.
Yes.
And we're not just making stuff up. The people who are really dangerous are like the Jim Jones types, you know, from
right.
Jonestown, the Jonestown Massacre, where they thought they could just make the rules. One of the issues that, I don't want to get overtly political, but one of the issues that some of us may have with our current governance is that the way our current president seems to operate, he basically seems to be using himself as his own compass. And that's profoundly dangerous all by itself, almost independently of what that compass is telling you to do. The fact that it's not grounded in tradition, which we shouldn't take tradition as absolutely given and not challenge it. Again, I refer back to, you know, Dr. King or Gandhi were very much challenging a lot of old traditions that they were saying, yeah, these are traditions, but they're wrong. But they were doing it from the standpoint of something much greater than themselves. They were religious people. They were people of faith.
Absolutely. And even secular writers, like in the Enlightenment, which were really fairly radical new ideas in their day, were building them off ancient ideas. And more importantly, to connect to what you were saying, they were deeply rooted in some clear core values.
Do you have any thoughts about how people might deal with the spate of crises that we're all going through now?
Right now, when people are very triggered, very afraid, and very unnerved by such quick change, right? It may be we're those of us on the more progressive side are all wrong, and what we're looking at is a great blossoming that we won't know for 200 years. That's possible. I don't think so, but that's possible. And to remember that wherever I am right now, people have been in this situation, it is always the human condition. So I can take the time to pray, to breathe, to get away for a few days, to take care of myself. I hate that language because it almost cheapens what I'm talking about. It is self-care for sure, but it's something deeper than greater than that, which is I need to remember that this is the human condition. And that while I'm feeling really anxious right now, it is not necessarily right now an emergency. Mm. And how can I be urgent without getting into the space where I'm reacting from a sense of emergency?
Yeah, that is exactly what I talk about in terms of trauma, actually. That what converts a trigger to a memory is when it is no longer, when the memory, when being reminded of something, no longer constitutes an emergency.
Right.
Because when people respond with an emergency response, it feels like it's actually happening and they have to do something all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. Whereas when something is perceived as a memory, you've healed, basically. It's like, okay, I remember how bad that was, but I'm not in a panic about it right now.
The memory has a distance to it. It's not happening right now, and you know that, and that's really important. I guess the other thing that I think in terms of couples a lot is that the question, the Jewish concept of repentance, which is a bad translation for teshuvah, which is return or getting back on the path that you know is yours. Now, there's a very specific Jewish idea about that. But I think that imagery and that idea really helps because I think a lot of times in couples, one or both people will really just get away from who they are. And then the relationship starts to feel like not their relationship because they're not who they are in the relationship. They've lost themselves to some degree. And I think teshuvah, like taking time to reconnect with God, reconnect with your old friends, reconnect with who you are away from the couple, can really help you come back to the couple with more clarity. And I find that I use that concept pretty regularly, like how can we get back to who we are? Because if you feel like who you are is not in this relationship or is not seen or is not visible, then that's not a relationship that's going to work. So I think being seen is crucial.
So one other thing I want to ask you about, because you are a gay man and you've been, you know, 38 years in a relationship with your partner, I work, the large majority of the folks I work with are heterosexual couples, of the couples I work with, which isn't terribly surprising because I'm, you know, I'm not a gay man, I'm a heterosexual man and a heterosexual couple. That's where my expertise is. I have worked with a fair number over the years of gay men, couples, and also with lesbian couples. And one of the things I had to learn early on was, it's a buzzword I'm sure you know, the heteronormative assumptions I'm apt to be working with are assumptions that I better be open to looking at carefully. I'm curious if you'd like to comment on your experience of that from any direction as one who may have, perhaps you've made use of therapists. I don't know if you've made use, if you've made use of gay couples therapists or straight couples therapists or whatever you've...
All of the above. We've been in therapy a few times. I think one of the things is that all people are always different, right?
Yes, I learned that early.
You know, heteronormative assumptions are often off too, right? So that's...
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
That's one of the things to remember, because I don't want to give into stereotypes, but also lesbian relationships, if you're going to say in general, if there's such a thing, are different than gay male relationships in general. I think there's different issues that I've dealt with and that have come to me over the years. I think gay men can be much more flexible about dealing with their sexual lives, honestly, and talking about sex versus ownership or jealousy and where that comes from and what of that is really valid and what of that might not be. And I think many people, hetero, gay, lesbian, do that. But my experience has been, let me say it from there, that because the gay community, in so much as there is one, gives you a bit more reinforcement for more varieties of answers there, they're more talked about and people are aware of other models a little more broadly. So I think that actually helps, because I think a lot of times in relationships, one of the key problems is sexual. And it sometimes is a substitute for other problems, and sometimes it is the problem. And if you're not willing to talk about that, that's going to be really hard to solve. And I find that heterosexual couples sometimes are much less willing to actually talk about what works and what doesn't, at least in front of me. That may be because I'm the rabbi, but I, from my therapist friends, I think that's generally true to some degree.
That has certainly been my experience. And if I were going to, you know, broadly compare gay male couples I've worked with heterosexual couples I've worked with, that is very much.
Yeah. And I think that is a strength of gay couples.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's certainly something I, as a straight therapist, have learned a lot from working with gay couples in that very way. You know, and to have any of the assumptions, and you're absolutely right, you know, the heteronormative assumptions aren't even true for heterosexual people, you know, always.
Right.
You just,
right.
You always have to ask. If I've learned nothing else over the years, it's that I've learned how often my assumptions are just flat out inaccurate. I just basically assume they're mostly inaccurate. There's an assumption, you know, and so I just ask rather than assume.
Right. And you don't know what's going on with that couple. But I think that's exactly right. I think because as gay men, I'll just speak personally, I have friends in a wide range of coupled relationships in terms of how they manage that, in terms of the boundaries and sexual boundaries and all the and financial boundaries. So I have in my friendship group a lot of different models that I hear about and have to contend with and think about and think, you know, like they're in my environment. So they offer us ways of going, well, do you think that would work? And it makes us think about these things a little differently, I think, or gives us the reason to. Whereas if you're in a predominantly normative heterosexual environment and people aren't talking about it openly, regardless of what they're doing, if they're not sharing it in social circles, then you don't always have that need to wrestle with the ideas. Like, why am I jealous? Is that a good, is that okay? You know, because I think a lot of people feel very sanctimonious when they feel jealous. Like jealousy comes with a kind of sanctimony. And I think it's sometimes really helpful to go, well, is that really a place that I'm like so right? I think those things are, it's not a particularly Jewish concept, of course, but I think to me, getting back to we're all made in the image of God and we're all valuable and we all have a right to be valued and happy to the best of our abilities means that I'm trying to find Jewish ways in, but my main task is to try to help the couple or try to help the individual feel better. And if what it turns out makes them feel better is leaving religion entirely, then I may not support it, but I can at least talk to them about that honestly.
Are there some things you've learned from your relationship with your partner, Tim, that you think have helped you in this work?
One of the things I was just going to say is in Tim and I's relationship, for probably the first 20 years of our relationship, our motto was not, we are committed, we will not break up, no matter what happens, we're going to work through this. Our commitment was, we are going to stay in this as long as it is healthy for both of us. Like that was literally what we would say to each other. I want to be really clear. I am in this as long as it's healthy for both of us. And what that did for us, and I'm interested in this, right? Because I don't think that's the usual therapist line. But what I'm in, it kept us on our toes because we both realized like this isn't guaranteed. This is like could end at any minute if we don't do the work. And so thinking of it that way as opposed to death do we part, really helped us do the work we needed to do, right? Because we didn't want to split up, but we knew we could. And that's before gay marriage. So that was part of that context and all. But even now, I think sometimes the death till we part isn't the message that's most helpful in how to keep a relationship healthy.
So I'm guessing you weren't listening in on a session I had yesterday. I'm assuming that we didn't have this massive security breakdown
and
you were
actually
hearing it. Because that's what we were talking about. I was talking with a couple. And in fact, it was that I was saying something very similar, actually, that, you know, the notion of sort of unconditional love, which is kind of baked into that notion of till death do us part. And look, I come from a perspective that I take marriage very seriously. But I also think it's really important that people have a bottom line, because otherwise some really awful things can happen. And the fact of knowing, you know, I like to say, and I there's a gendered piece to this when I'm working with heterosexual couples. I say this especially to men, you know. I mean, I think women can hear it too, but especially to men. It's like we men should be thinking, you know, she's got other options. you got to catch there, and she's got other options. And if you don't keep her happy, she might really take a second look at this. And so I'd love to think, and here I am, you know, interviewing together with my wife here. I would love to think that she will love me forever, no matter how much of a jerk I am. Actually, I say that. I really don't want to think that. I think, no, if I'm enough of a jerk, she should dump me like a hot potato. Mm. And I want to know that so that will, I hope, tend to, first of all, not take her for granted, and also treat her in ways that I want to keep convincing her that, no, you made a good bet by marrying me.
Right.
So I think that idea that says, and, you know, and to your point, it's important to recognize, I think everybody should be in a marriage. I'm very glad we live in a culture that allows divorce.
Yes.
I'm old enough. You are too, I guess. We're all in this conversation old enough to remember before the divorce laws liberalized in the 1970s.
Yes.
And it was really hard in some cases, sometimes perfectly awful cases. It was hard to get a divorce. And I think it's important that it's not that hard. I also do take marriage very seriously.
In a Jewish wedding ceremony, there is no till death do us part.
No, that's right.
You know, that's not part of the language.
No, in fact, right in the ketubah are the what you have to do if you divorce.
Well, no, and that's one of the things that I think influenced me in thinking that way, is anytime you're talking to a couple getting married, and especially if one of them grew up Christian and is now either converted or secular, and you're looking at that, I have to explain every time, you know, a Jewish wedding is not about marrying your souls for all eternity. It's a contract between two adults entering into a relationship and building a home together. Like, that's what this is. Mm-hmm. It's not this metaphysical moment. It's meaningful and deeply meaningful, but it's not some mystical bond that I've now put upon you. And so I think the flip side of that is when I'm having trouble, it's like, I have to make this work if it's going to work, because it's a contract and I have obligations in that contract, right? Which a lot of people will see that's not very spiritual, but part of what I love about Judaism is like, that is actually spiritual, and how you fulfill your contracts and how you do business is part and parcel of your spirituality. It's not this rarefied thing over there when you're, you know, breathing.
Right. And it's not all about you either. You know, it's you within a context of the greater community.
That's right.
So your happiness, you know, the community is vested in your happiness, and, you know, vice versa. So it's to your benefit to stay together.
Yeah. Yes. The open sides of the chuppah are all about that.
Yes, that's exactly.
The wedding canopy. Yeah. And, you know, that I do point out in my book that It is indeed a contract. It's also a covenant. In other words, there is that element of an expression of your basic identity.
Yes.
That you're really changing your identities when you marry, which is why I think, and of course I invite your comment on this, this is why I'm thinking it was so important for gay marriage, not merely civil union. Because civil union doesn't say that. Civil union is all about the contract,
right,
which is indeed absolutely important. But until it's sanctified, you don't have the same thing. And so the sanctity part isn't that it can never change. And indeed, the sanctity part is not inviolable. You know, if you violate the contract part, you may have to to dissolve the covenant part. But it is nevertheless a covenant.
Yes.
It's more than just the contract.
Well, I think that's true. I guess what I would maybe push back a little bit on is, to me, what makes it holy. And this is where our tradition talks much less about the beliefs about this sort of thing, is what makes it holy. It's two adult people fully and willingly entering into this this covenant, this agreement, this relationship. Mm-hmm. There is nothing more profound or powerful or complex in the human life. Like, it's maybe having a child, right? Like, those are profound. And that's another, that's holy as well, because you are making a commitment when you have that child, right? So to me, that commitment in the face of complexity, in the face of difference, is holy. It's an obligation. It's a duty. Mm-hmm. And duty is value. Yeah. It's holy. When I said metaphysical, I don't need to feel that our souls are joined. I don't know what that means, frankly.
Yeah. Yeah. If I understand what you're saying, I mean, what you're pointing out, and I think it's an important point, what you're pointing out is we can get lost in the mystical aspects of this sacred union in two souls. But what you're saying is no, don't ignore the amazing sanctity of people actually living up to their obligations in the presence of complexity, in the presence
Absolutely.
Of difficulty. That's an amazing thing that Judaism elevates to the whole.
I agree.
Thank you. That was a great way for us to end up, wrap up our conversation. And thank you so much.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity. I think this is great that you're doing this.
So I hope you enjoyed that as much as we did. And it was great to have Rabbi Edelson with us. We also want to remind you that we would love to hear your questions and topic suggestions. So please email them to bruce@brucechalmer.com or visit the website brucechalmer.com.
And when you visit the website brucechalmer.com, if you go to the podcast tab, you'll note, first of all, you can actually listen to our podcasts from there. But also you'll notice that we are actually asking if you or anybody you know would like to be a guest on an upcoming podcast. And if so, you can actually go to a link there on the site that will take you to a calendar, and you can sign up for a time where we will interview you. And as part of that process, we'll ask you what you'd like to be interviewed about, so we'll have a chance to see if we think you'll be a good fit for the show. So we would love to hear from you on that. Judy, tell us about our next program.
Okay, our next topic is called Getting Hold of Yourself.
And that topic, we're going to be picking up on that idea of what do you do about anxiety? What do you do about, you know, we're still in the don't panic part of the book. And just to remind you about the book is called Reigniting the Spark, Why Stable Couples Lose Intimacy and How to Get It Back. It's available anywhere books are sold. And I hope you will order it and enjoy it. You can also get the audiobook, which I actually narrated, and that's available through Audible on Amazon.com. So until next time.
Thank you for listening, and be kind.
Don't panic.
And have faith.